Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your source for views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the hour. I have a piece of good news for you this morning. As reported in The Guardian, at least 16 data center projects worth a combined $64 billion have been blocked or delayed due to local opposition to rising electricity costs. That's called fighting back. And that's what we do at KBOO. We bring you the facts and analysis and foster the connections you need to build your communities and fight back. Now, more than ever, we need alternative radio. Please support KBOO if you can. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Today on our show, I'll be reading excerpts from an article about the Jeffrey Epstein files and what they reveal about how global elites wield and maintain their grip on power. I'm warning you, it is not a pretty picture. Fran Michel speaks with housing advocates Nikki Dardinger and Katie Spinagle about the recent report on what homeless persons want. Guess what? They want homes, not shelters. In honor of the holidays, our music today is drawn from a long and rich tradition of using the season to remind us of the struggles of the oppressed, past and current. Our songs will include The Rock Ballad of Harry T. Moore by Sweet Honey and the Rock, about the murdered civil rights activist. We'll also hear Peter, Paul and Mary singing Light One Candle, about the Maccabees and their fight for religious freedom, and whose victory is celebrated each year with the Festival of Lights, or Hanukkah. Last night was the first of the 8 nights of Hanukkah this year. I'm going to begin the show today with a poem for the season, a poem for our times. It's called For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet, by Joy Harjo. Harjo was the United States Poet Laureate in 2019. Born in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1951, Harjo is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Reading today is guest poetry mole Catherine Bax.
For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth, gathering essence of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. If you sing, it will give your spirit lift to fly to the stars' ears and back. Acknowledge this earth, who has cared for you since you were a dream, planting itself precisely within your parents' desire. Let your moccasined feet take you to the encampment of the guardians who have known you before time, who will be there after time. They sit before the fire that has been there without time. Let the earth stabilize your post-colonial insecure jitters. Be respectful of the small insects, birds, and animal people who accompany you. Let their forgiveness for the harm we humans have brought down upon them. Don't worry. The heart knows the way, though there may be high rises, interstates, checkpoints, armed soldiers, massacres, wars, and those who will despise you because they despise themselves. The journey might take you a few hours, a day, a year, a few years, 100, 1,000, or even more. Watch your mind. Without training, it might run away and leave your heart for the immense human feast set by the thieves of time. Do not hold regrets. When you find your way to the circle, to the fire kept burning by the keepers of your soul, you will be welcomed. You must clean yourself with cedar, sage, and other healing plant. Cut the ties you have to failure and shame. Let go the pain you are holding in your mind, your shoulders, your heart, all the way to your feet. Let go the pain of your ancestors to make way for those who are heading in our direction. Ask for forgiveness. Call upon the help of those who love you. These helpers take many forms: animal, element, bird, angel, saint, stone, or ancestor. Call your spirit back. It may be caught in corners and creases of shame, judgment, and human abuse. You must call in a way that your spirit will want to return. Speak to it as you would to a beloved child. Welcome your spirit back from its wandering. It may return in pieces, in tatters. Gather them together. They will be happy to be found after being lost for so long. Your spirit will need to sleep a while after it is bathed and given clean clothes. Now you can have a party. Invite everyone you know who loves and supports you. Keep room for those who have no place else to go. Make a giveaway, and remember, keep the speeches short. Then you must do this. Help the next person find their way through the dark.
That was a poem by Joy Harjo called "For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet," read by our guest poetry mole, Catherine Bax. Now I'd like to turn to Fran Michelle speaking with Sisters of the Road Executive Director Nikki Dardinger and Systemic Change Organizer Katie Spinagel about the Finding Home study that was just published. The report busts a bunch of myths about the experiences and desires of homeless people, and it suggests that Mayor Wilson's policies on homelessness are going in the wrong direction. Here's Fran.
For the past 2 years, Sisters of the Road and the Welcome Home Coalition, two local groups focused on supporting homeless people and advocating for housing justice, collaborated to conduct research in Portland and learn from people who are currently homeless or have been homeless in the past 5 years what they want and need to stay housed. The study applied participatory action research methods, including surveys and small group consultations, engaging over 650 people with lived experience with homelessness in the Portland metro area. And it also draws on prior research on homelessness and on advice from researchers from Portland State University and Oregon Health and Science University. The report is titled "Finding Home: Lasting Housing Solutions Rooted in Community Expertise." You can find it linked on the site of the welcomehomecoalition.org or at the page for this segment at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. With me today to talk about the Finding Home report are Sisters of the Road Executive Director Nikki Dardinger and Systemic Change Organizer Katie Spinagel. Thank you, Nikki and Katie, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having us. We're happy to be here.
The report has a wealth of information. There's a useful glossary, a history of affordable housing, analysis, discussion of methodology, discussion of findings, policy recommendations. It's a really clear, beautifully presented, informative report. So I recommend people check it out. Top line finding: the survey found that over 90% of those surveyed would move into a house or apartment immediately if they could afford it, and vastly preferred a house or apartment to other options like shelter, which were just as bad as being on the street. So I got to say, this seems kind of unsurprising. I mean, I know I prefer to live in a house rather than in a shelter. So I'm kind of wondering, do we need scholarly research to find out that people prefer houses and apartments rather than shelters? Or I guess more broadly, what's the purpose? What's the motive behind this study?
I love that question. I think that one of the things when we start talking about homelessness and poverty, So often we are not listening to the true experts in the room when it comes to homelessness and poverty. And those are the people who have experienced it, whether they are unhoused now or have been unhoused in the past. These are folks who really understand what it's like, who know what's needed, and have just the most expertise when it comes to the solutions. And so when Sisters of the Road and our partners at the Welcome Home Coalition, as we worked on this report, it was so important to us to really center the voices of people who are experts in homelessness and who can really help us to solve these challenges that our city is facing. Katie, what do you think? What would you add?
Yeah, I think it also addresses this narrative that is outdated and inaccurate, which is that, folks want to be homeless and choose homelessness, which I don't know where that narrative first started because it's unsurprising to us, people doing the work, that that's super inaccurate.
So over 90% of people surveyed said they want to be in a house or apartment if they could afford it. What about the rest of that group that didn't quite make it to 100%? Why not?
Yeah, so I think my prediction is that folks just know they can't afford it. So they just answered it as if, like, no, I won't be able to afford it. So I can't move into a spot. I think that's the confusion on that question, probably.
I think that one of the other things that we heard is some folks really expressing a distrust in our systems, where they've tried to get housing in the past and maybe they've been offered a voucher or some like short-term rental assistance, but then it doesn't work out or it goes away. And so folks have really sometimes just lost trust in our systems, and that makes them hesitant to engage with those systems again, which is really fair. And so I think for some of the folks, in addition to what Katie said, folks just really not seeing how they could possibly afford housing, some of it is also just truly a non-belief that it would work out for them.
Yeah, in the data set info, which is on public Tableau. So if people want to dig more deeply into this, that information is available. It kind of looked like the answers to the if not, why not follow up on that was, I don't have any income, which seems to suggest they're just like, I can't even go to the hypothetical in that. But yeah, if it's unsurprising that people would like to be in housing, it did strike me as something I wouldn't have thought of, that people felt like the anxiety about housing being unstable was worse than just staying where they knew they had a tent or something, that the concern about cycling in and out of housing was enough to be kind of a deterrent. It seems like there are also problems, other kinds of problems, with some of the housing offered, as well as, of course, we'll get to the problems with shelter and why that's just as bad as being on the street. But it seems like the housing that's being offered to people has a lot of restrictions. There's curfews, they can't have visitors, it's in terrible locations that they can't get to. Can you talk about maybe those as possible deterrents or problems with people navigating the system to get into housing that works for them?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think that one of the things that comes to mind for me when I hear that question is that when people are living on the streets, they build really wonderful and supportive communities for themselves. And they have just their friends, they have partners, they have places that they know and are comfortable with. And so often, when folks do get into housing, those housing options are away from the community that they have built. Perhaps they are no longer with their friends. Perhaps they are no longer in the same part of town where they are familiar with the services available to them. Where living outside, whether that's in an encampment or even perhaps like alone or spending some time in shelters, again, like people build really wonderful communities and friendships, and then they move into housing, which can be very isolating and very lonely. And we know that it's hard to stay stable in housing when you're lonely and isolated and don't have access to the things that you need.
There was a participant during, I think, the data walks that we did for the report that had said they keep telling us that we need to engage with the community and like be involved to be able to stay housed. But then they put us in these Section 8 housing situations that are so isolated from our community, and they wonder why people don't want to be in those types of housing. So it's just contradictory, you know?
So this is another example of why it's important to have the real experts weighing in on this, to let the people making policies understand what they're getting wrong and how to make it better. Can you talk a little about Housing First and the notion of supportive housing and peer supports? Because it also seemed like some of the problem was there are resources, but people can't find them, can't access them. It's difficult to work through the bureaucracy of getting into housing or getting assistance for housing. What are some of those obstacles and solutions?
Well, when I think about Housing First, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what Housing First is, right? Housing First is a model, and the model says, hey, we know that it is easier for people to have a job when they have housing already, to engage in treatment, whether that is for their physical health or their mental health or substance use and addiction, that it is easier for them to do that when they are stably housed. And so Housing First is a model that says, hey, everyone deserves to be housed. Everyone deserves, the dignity and a place to live. And so let's work on getting folks housed. And then it's not housing only. So we often say housing first doesn't mean housing only. And so it's once folks are housed, it's okay, now we can work on what are your goals? Do we need to support with some job training skills? Do we need some help navigating work? Do you need help navigating your benefits that you are entitled to? Hey, can we help get you connected to treatment, get you into a dentist appointment, whatever it might be that people need? All of those things are so much more doable when you have housing, when you have your housing taken care of. I'm curious, Katie, what would you add to that?
Well, I was going to say that's part of what is missing from deeply affordable and affordable housing currently is the wraparound services once you get into housing. So again, that isolation factor, right, where folks get into housing and then they're just expected to be good and that's it. It's like, no, you still need that support. So peer support you mentioned, where someone has already navigated the systems and has maintained housing, can be a supportive figure to someone going through that process. And so that's something that I think, and a bunch of experts think is missing from affordable housing currently is the wraparound services. We say wraparound services all the time, but what it actually looks like in practice is different.
And one of the things that's part of that is peer support.
Yeah, so I mean, as Katie mentioned, that peer support piece is really important. And we heard that throughout the Finding Home Research Project when we were doing surveys and focus groups. People told us like that peer support piece is really important. And you had mentioned earlier that sometimes just navigating the systems is really difficult. And so peers often serve in this way, but sometimes folks really need a dedicated case manager. So someone who is helping them just navigate housing, navigate landlords, navigate the Social Security office, like make a health primary care appointment. So having those supports, whether it's a peer support who can really say like, hey, I've done this. It is possible. It is possible for you to be successful in housing. I did it, and let me share with you, what I learned and help you through it. And sometimes it is a case manager or a social worker who is saying like, let me help you navigate these systems. We're gonna do this together, right? People often tell us like they're not looking for a handout. They want to engage. They just want some support. They need some support and guidance with navigating what really are very complex systems.
This is Patricia Kohlberg, your host today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm interrupting this interview to remind you that the KBOO community has lots of experience with fighting back. We've been fighting back against corporate media for decades, and you can help us continue the battle by donating to support KBOO. We're hoping to raise $75,000 this holiday season, and every donation, big and small, counts. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. And while you're in the mood to donate, think about becoming a monthly supporter. And now back to Fran Michel with her guests, Nikki Dardinger and Katie Spinagle.
You mentioned deeply affordable housing. There was a recent report about there being affordable apartments sitting empty in Portland. But you're talking about deeply affordable housing, so maybe we should clarify that distinction.
Well, I don't know if there's a 100% like this is how deeply affordable is defined, but the reality is that affordable housing is still not affordable for people with very low incomes. Some folks, they might have a disability where they cannot work, or they cannot work at the number of hours that are needed to be able to afford even an affordable apartment here in our city. And so when we talk about deeply affordable housing, we're talking about housing with folks with extremely low incomes can still afford to rent or have access to some rental assistance or to permanent supportive housing that will help them be able to stay housed.
I mean, this report is really looking at and talking to people who have been unhoused, on the streets, unsheltered. I mean, there is kind of a spectrum, though, of housing difficulty. I mean, over half of renters in Portland are rent burdened. It's costing more than 30% of their income. A quarter are paying half of their income for rent. So this is part of a spectrum of housing insecurity that leads to people doubling up for a while or staying in motels or living in RVs and ending up then because there aren't adequate supports, because the wages are too low, the rent is too high, they're physically or for other reasons unable to work, there aren't decent jobs. They have disabilities, they're old, not everybody is able to work full time all the time. So there's a spectrum of housing insecurity, of which unsheltered is one end that we would like to see people not arrive at. But once they do, they're likely to need more support in getting back into stable housing.
Absolutely. You touched on so many things. One thing that you mentioned that I just think about is this piece around unsheltered homelessness, and we want to keep people from being unhoused. And so something that we are talking about, and I think need to be talking about even more, is how do we prevent people from being homeless in the first place? We need to talk about everything. We need to talk about for folks who are unhoused now, how do we get them housing, support them accessing housing? But we also need to talk about once people are housed, how do we keep them housed? So often, people are truly, and I know we say this, but people are truly one paycheck or two paychecks away from not being able to pay their rent. Or they get hit with an unexpected medical bill, or childcare falls through. And there are just any number of things that could happen where all of a sudden someone can't pay their rent and then they're at risk of losing their housing. And so, one of the things that finding home, one of the recommendations is that we work to keep people housed, that we have programs in place to prevent evictions for some emergency rental assistance to help people through those unexpected emergencies that keep them housed and that keep them from needing to be either on the streets or, as you mentioned, doubling up or living in their cars. Like, what we really need to do is to keep people housed and to make sure that we have some supportive systems in place to prevent those evictions from happening. So, I really appreciate you saying that it isn't just about how do we support people who are currently unhoused into getting housing, but it's, as you mentioned, so many folks are rent burdened. So many folks are struggling to afford their rent because you summed it up, right? Rents are really high, and our wages, our minimum wage here in Portland, like you can't afford an apartment in Portland, if you're on minimum wage or making low income. So how do we make sure that we can support people to stay in the housing that they have?
So we're getting people housed, but then more people are becoming unhoused, and so the problem keeps getting worse. What about shelter? I mean, the mayor has really leaned on his shelter plan, and he's opening these new beds, and yet people who have had these experiences are saying shelter is just as bad as living on the street. Can you talk about the different kinds of shelter and why it's so bad and what's going on with trying to get people sheltered rather than housed?
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about surprises, and hey, like we shouldn't be surprised, right, that people want to live in houses. But even though I wasn't surprised necessarily, it did impact me to really see that data and to see that people who are unhoused believe that our shelters in Portland are as equally as undesirable as living outside on the street. And I think that tells us something, right? That tells us something about our shelters, and it tells us that people don't want to go there. And I think we need to be listening to that. And we need to be listening to, okay, well, if that doesn't work, what can we do to make them better? So when it comes to shelter, there are lots of different kinds of shelter, and the shelters that the city has been, creating these shelter beds, they tend to be overnight shelter only. They're often congregate shelters, so mat on the floor, you come in, you get a mat, you don't necessarily get to stay with your partner. You might not be allowed to bring your pets, which are very important to the people, and you might be woken up at 6:30 in the morning and put right back out on the street to go about your day. And it's winter just about here in Portland, so it's cold and it's raining, and that is how people, start their day coming out of an overnight congregate shelter. One of the things that I like to say is we're not saying there should be no shelter. Like, shelters play a really important part of the housing continuum of services. They can be a really important transition point for folks who are unhoused and need to have a place to go while they figure out how to get back into permanent housing. So we think of shelters, they should be rare, and it should be a transition point for people. So when I think about the shelters that are doing a good job, these are shelter. There are some shelters where they are providing 24/7 services. They have really robust supports. They might have peer supports. They might have case managers. They might have inreach specialists and like housing navigation specialists. So, and they're also just treating people with dignity. There's maybe private spaces. There's showers. There's lunch. Laundry. There's all of these things that are just treat people like the whole human beings that they are, and then really work closely with people to figure out what kind of housing they need, because not everyone needs the same type of housing. Some people really need a very short-term transitional housing type model with maybe just a few months of rent assistance. Other folks might need housing for up to 2 years. There are some rental assistance programs for up to 2 years. And still other folks might need permanent supportive housing. So folks with disabilities who really need those long-term housing supports and long-term case management where they're really going to need support to stay housed. So all that to be said, when we think about shelters, it's, hey, we really don't need any more overnight congregate shelters that aren't providing really any services that help people transition to being housed. If we are really thinking about shelters, we need to be looking at which shelters are successful at housing people. And again, those are going to be those shelters that have robust services and are really designed to transition folks to housing. Katie, I'm curious what you would add about shelters.
I think you covered most of what I want to say. The main thing in direct response to the shelter efforts by the mayor and the city is like, I want everyone to fully understand that shelter is not housing. And I keep saying that at the beginning of most conversations about shelter. Yes, we do need some form of shelter. It should be better. The effort should be going into those wraparound services that also need to be part of housing. But yeah, I just want to continue to make it really clear that shelter is not housing.
Hey, that's so important. I feel like we start our conversations so often with people who are staying in shelters are still homeless. Like, by definition, if you are in a shelter, you are still homeless. And we recognize that the mayor has been talking about unsheltered homelessness, but ending unsheltered homelessness, which we have not successfully done, is not ending homelessness. What really ends homelessness is getting people into real, permanent, safe, and stable housing.
Seems clear from the terms. If you're housed, you have a house or apartment. Were there other findings in the study that surprised you, or are there other things that you want people to be sure to take away from this report?
As someone that's been doing the work for a long time now, most of the findings were not surprising to me, but they are findings that I think are super important for folks that aren't doing the work to have a better understanding of. And it's really important that they came from our community members that are experiencing homelessness, because like Nikki mentioned earlier, like people experiencing homelessness are the experts in this experience. So I think this report is for folks that don't necessarily have that full understanding.
Yeah, when I think about the things that I want people to take away, like, one, I echo everything that Katie just said, and would add that it's really complex. This is a really complex challenge because we're talking about people. Like we're talking about real human beings. These are our neighbors. These are whole people with whole lives and a whole diverse range of lived experiences and needs. And so it really does take a community. It really takes a continuum of supportive services. And I think that when we think about where we're investing our funds, we really need to be looking at, of course, like the whole continuum and making sure that no matter where a person is, whether they're staying in a shelter, they're staying in their car, or perhaps they're in a transitional housing program, like we need to make sure that there is support for all of those services. And I think we really need to be looking at doing things that are successful. So I think, again, like what we're seeing is that overnight congregate shelters, they're not as successful. So we don't need any more of them. What we really need is to improve the shelters that we have, because as soon as you are successful in helping someone transition into housing, that frees up their shelter bed for another person. And so we don't want to just be warehousing humans in shelters. We want those shelter environments to be treating people with dignity and with supporting folks with what they need to be able to get housed. So, like, let's invest in that. Like, let's invest in truly helping people get real housing and not just shelters.
If listeners want to get involved, want to find out more, want to weigh in, want to help out, what do you recommend that people do to support solving the problems of housing and houselessness in Portland?
Yeah, love that question. So definitely encourage folks to check out the report. So our partners at the Welcome Home Coalition have the report available where you can like read through the whole thing. We also have some great one-pagers in English and Spanish, and those one-pagers can be shared more broadly in the community. We have some social media posts for folks that might want to share more about the findings and the recommendations to their community. But we also really encourage people to get to know your elected officials. So here in Portland, we all have city council representatives, we have county commissioners, and they are accountable to us, to the people who live here. And so we really encourage folks to write letters, talk to them, attend meetings. Folks can testify at meetings and to really be able to share that we care about homelessness in Portland. Something I love about Portlanders is I think we just really deeply care about people, and we want people to be housed, and we want our government and our community to help people get housed and to put systems in place that make that possible. So, really encourage people to reach out to elected officials and tell them what matters to you. And hopefully, that they should be, listening to people with lived expertise when making their decisions and involving people with lived expertise in that decision-making process.
To add, you want to include the community and people having those experiences. To do that, go out and talk to folks. Like, they're people and their voices really matter. And if you get to know folks, you're going to have a better understanding of more actions you can take to be supportive.
So, talk to your neighbors, whether they're housed or not.
Yes.
Contact your city councilors, get involved in local government, weigh in, let them know that it makes more sense, both at an economic and a human level, to keep people housed rather than put them in shelters, that we need more housing and more supportive housing and housing first instead of just more beds on the floor.
Absolutely. And of course, Portland, we have some amazing nonprofits who are doing incredible work in our city. And so I also really, this is the season of generosity. And of course, Sisters of the Road is a nonprofit organization, and we rely on and are so grateful for all the support of our communities, our partners at the Welcome Home Coalition, so many partners in Portland who are helping folks to get housed, to make sure folks have meals, to make sure folks get the peer support services and other supportive services they need. So really encourage people to think about not, it doesn't even just have to be money. It can be volunteering. It can be donations of supplies. We have the Homeless Day of Remembrance coming up on December 21st. And so folks can check that out. There's a whole list of supplies that are often very needed by our community. And so there are lots of ways for folks to make a very significant impact and difference.
Great. Thank you, Nikki and Katie, for talking with me about the Finding Home report today.
Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much.
shopper shopping on a neon city street. Another Christmas dollar for another Christmas tree. Fair satin on the pretty dolls that make the children glow, while a boy is walking ragged in the cold Kentucky snow. No, they don't have Christmas in Kentucky. There's no holly on a West Virginia door, for the trees don't twinkle when you're hungry, and the jingle bells don't jingle when you're poor. There's lots of toys for children when the Christmas time is near, but the present for the miners is a stocking full of fear. In the dark hills of Kentucky, there's one gift that may be found, the coldest of forgotten days that's lying on the ground. No, they don't have Christmas in Kentucky. There's no holly on a West Virginia door, for the trees don't twinkle when you're hungry, and the jingle bells don't jingle when you're poor. Let's drink a toast to Congress and a toast to Santa Claus, and a toast to all the speeches that bring the loud applause. There's not enough to give, no, there's just not enough to share, so we'll drown the sounds of sorrow with a hearty Christmas cheer. No, they don't have Christmas in Kentucky. There's no holly on a West Virginia door, don't twinkle when you're hungry, and the jingle bells don't jingle when you're poor. Have a merry, merry Christmas and a happy New Year's Day, for now's a time of plenty, plenty's here to stay. But if you knew what Christmas was, I think that you would find Christ is spending Christmas in the cold Kentucky mine. Christmas in Kentucky. There's no holly on a West Virginia door, for the trees don't twinkle when you're hungry, and the jingle bells don't jingle when you're poor.
That was Phil Oakes with his song about Christmas when you're down and out. It's called No Christmas in Kentucky. Before that, you heard about the Finding Home report from Fran Michel, Nikki Dardinger, and Katie Spinagle. By now, you probably know that KBOO is losing more than $100,000 because of federal cutbacks to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But we know our listeners have our back. There are those who would like nothing better than to watch KBOO shrivel up and die. But with your help, we're fighting back. Please give to KBOO if you can. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, by hitting the donate button on your KBOO app, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. On Christmas night in Florida in 1951, the Ku Klux Klan murdered civil rights activists Harry and Harriet Moore. Sweet Honey in the Rock turned that story into the rock ballad of Harry T. Moore. In this live recording, Sweet Honey in the Rock tells his story.
Harry Moore was an organizer in the state of Florida. He was killed along with his wife in 1951 on Christmas night. During the 30s and the 40s, they organized NAACP chapters in the state of Florida. There were more registered black voters in the state of Florida than in all of the other southern states combined. He was so good, they had to kill him. And we spent a lot of time trying to stay this side of death. like we gonna make it, you know. You could really go for broke. You gonna die anyway. Make a difference. It seems I hear Harry Moore from the earth, his voice still cries. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold. Freedom never dies. It happened in Florida, the land of flowers. It was on a Christmas night. Men came stealing through the orange grove. Men of hate carrying dynamite. It was to a little cottage, the family, the name of Moore. At the window hung sprigs of holly, a fine wreath at the door. It was on a Christmas evening and the family prayers were said. Mother, father, daughter, and grandmother went to bed. The father's name was Harry Moore of the NAACP. He fought for the right for us to live. Black folk must be free. It seems I hear Harry Moore from the earth, his voice still cries. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold, for freedom never dies. Freedom never dies, I say. Freedom never dies. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold, but freedom never dies. It could not be in Jesus' name beneath the bedroom floor. On Christmas night, the killers hid the bomb for Harry Moore. It could not be in Jesus' name. The killers took his life and blew his home to pieces and killed his faithful wife. It could not be for the sake of love they did this awful thing. For when the bomb exploded and the Moors died, no hearts were heard to sing. And certainly no angels cried, peace on earth, goodwill to men. But around the world, an echo hurled a question, when? When will people in Jesus' name, and when will they by prayer, know that each one has the right to stand up everywhere? When will people, for the sake of peace, the sake of democracy, know that no bomb you can make can stop us from being free? It seems I hear Harry Moore from the earth, his voice still cries. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold, for freedom never dies. Freedom never dies, I say. Freedom never dies. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold, for freedom never dies.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with the Rock Ballad of Harry T. Moore. Now, as the Moles well read, I'm going to share with you an edited version of an interesting article by Middle East scholar Sumaya Ghanoushi, who argues that the Jeffrey Epstein story provides a behind-the-scenes look at global elites and their machinations. The article is titled, Epstein Saga Exposes Israel's Iron Grip on U.S. Power. It was originally published in Middle East Eye on November 20. Ghanoushi writes, the Epstein leaks have reopened a door many in Washington hoped would remain sealed. Not the door of gossip, rather the door that leads into the machinery of American power. These leaks expose an unholy triangle of money, politics, and sex, whose central thread leads to a foreign influence network that has learned to govern the world's most powerful nation through seduction, dependence, and capture. This is not a conspiracy theory. It is not an anti-Semitic delusion. It is what the documents show and what Washington's behavior confirms. They show, firstly, that Epstein was never simply a brilliant fraud. He was a facade, the social face of an intelligence apparatus designed to corrupt, compromise, and control. His network was not accidental. His closest confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell, was the daughter of Robert Maxwell, long reported to have worked closely with Israeli intelligence. His investments flowed into ventures led by Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister. Barak headed Carbine, an Israeli security tech firm in which Epstein quietly placed funds. Investigations by DropSite make the picture even clearer. Epstein was not just socially adjacent to Israeli intelligence, he was operationally useful. The outlet's reporting reveals that Epstein helped broker a security agreement between Israel and Mongolia, tried to establish a back channel to Russia during the Syria war, and facilitated a security deal between Israel and Côte d'Ivoire. These were not social favors. They were state-level services. The leaks also lay bare something even darker, the mindset of the American elites who moved through Epstein's world, men who treated him not as a danger nor even a pariah, but as a peer, a gatekeeper, a magnet. They sought him out because he stood at the crossroads of wealth, intelligence, and elite indulgence. To be noticed by him was to be noticed by the network behind him. To please him was to be invited into a world where consequences evaporated. Epstein became the public face of a quiet, sprawling intelligence octopus. Elites did not stumble into his orbit by accident. They pursued it. They recognized what he could offer: immunity, access, indulgence, and the patronage of a foreign lobby that had perfected the art of capturing nations by feeding the appetites of their rulers. And it was precisely this moral rot, this elite hunger for vice without consequences, that made them easy to control. A compromised man is a manageable man. A guilty man is an obedient man. Epstein's world became a factory of leverage, a catalog of weakness, a marketplace of blackmail. But Epstein was only one instrument. There was also the daylight arm, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. If Epstein was the covert, psychological, compromising tool of influence, APAC was the public, financial, legislative one. One captured the elite through their appetites. The other captured Congress through money. One seduced, the other purchased. Together they formed the shadow and surface of the same structure. Yet, something is shifting in the American political landscape. The lobby's aura of inevitability is cracking. APAC's annual congressional trips are collapsing. In 2023, a total of 24 first-term Democrats attended. This year, only 11 out of 33 went. Voters, especially young and Democratic-leaning blocs, are rejecting candidates backed by pro-Israel lobbying groups. Polls from the Arab American Institute show that such endorsements are now more likely to cost votes than bring them. Pressure is mounting from every direction. Broadcasters and interviews now challenge politicians live on air, puncturing the old aura of untouchability. You can see it in Senator Cory Booker squirming when asked whether Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom repeating, "Interesting," when the subject of APAC is broached. And in Pennsylvania, Governor Josh Shapiro being pressed on whether the lobby distorts American policy. As one progressive Jewish commentator put it, they don't fear APAC, they fear being associated with APAC. But here lies the paradox. The pro-Israel lobby's domestic legitimacy might be collapsing, yet its grip on foreign policy remains intact. Influence does not disappear simply because it becomes unpopular. Public opinion can shift rapidly. The machinery of power does not. And so, even as Democratic politicians distance themselves, U.S. foreign policy remains bent to Israeli priorities. No empire in history has subordinated its grand strategy to the anxieties of a much smaller state, except an empire whose elites are compromised, corrupted, and controlled. Internally, democracy has decayed. Elections are auctions. Representatives are assets. Public opinion is shaped by media ecosystems funded by the same networks that bankroll political careers. Democracy has become a performance staged by a political class whose private lives make them permanently vulnerable. This is the true meaning of the Epstein leaks. They expose not a single predator, but a system built on moral decay, foreign influence, intelligence engineering, and elite complicity. Epstein was not an anomaly. He was the model. Trump remains its clearest illustration, a man who wrapped himself in patriotism while tethered to foreign influence and moral ruin. And so the U.S. confronts a question that can no longer be buried. Who governs the country? Its elected officials or the foreign network that owns their secrets, funds their campaigns, and exploits their corruption? How can a nation claim sovereignty when its leaders are so easily compromised? How can a republic claim legitimacy when its elites are so cheaply bought? How can a superpower lead the world when it cannot even govern itself? When does the U.S. insist, not in slogans, but in action, that its government belongs to its people, not to Tel Aviv?
Oh, Santa, I've been waiting on you.
That's funny, kid, because I've been coming for you.
Oh, Santa, I've been killing just for fun.
Well, the party's over, kid, because I got a bullet in my gun.
A bullet in your what?
That was Don't Shoot Me, Santa by The Killers. Before the music, you heard excerpts from an article by Soumaya Ghanouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics. A link to the full article is posted on the webpage for this show. That's it for our show today. I want to thank Mole Fran Michelle for her contribution, and a special thank to her guests, Nikki Dardinger and Katie Spinagle. Thanks as well to our guest poetry mole, Catherine Bax. As always, much gratitude to the staff at KBOO for making it all happen. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. One reason the feds don't want to support the likes of KBOO is because we lift up a diversity of voices. So many communities have found a home at KBOO to share their happenings, their culture, their music. If you think that's important, please support Community Radio in Portland. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, by tapping the donate button on your KBOO mobile app, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214. I'm leaving you this morning with a song by Peter, Paul, and Mary about the Maccabees and their struggle for religious freedom. The Moles wish you wonderful holidays. Thanks for listening, and join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up.
That answers some of those painful questions. It says, light one candle. A candle on a menorah. The Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. Light a candle for decency. Light a candle for hope. Light a universal candle for peace. Light one candle for the Maccabee children, with thanks to their light it didn't die. And light one candle for the pain they endured when their right to exist was denied. Light one candle for the terrible sacrifice justice and freedom demand. But light one candle for the wisdom to know when the peacemaker's time is at hand. For so many years, don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. Don't let the light go out. It's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. Light one candle for the strength that we need to never become our own foe. And light one candle for those who are suffering pain we learned so long ago. Light one candle for all we believe in. Let anger not tear us apart. And light one candle to bind us together with peace as a song in our heart. Don't let the light go out. It's lasted for so long.